All right, we're ready. I guess we're fresh from a new exam, so we should be a little bit more attentive. But let's get going. Topic today is chemical carcinogenesis. So carcinogenesis is the process of making cancer or creating tumor. So how does chemicals, exogenous, maybe even endogenous, help or potentiate that process is what we're going to try and talk about today. It's more of an overview, historical lecture rather than going into the details, because I will take you from the history from the top and then leave it at the point where phenomenon and signaling pathways have already been covered. So I expect you will understand going farther from there or deeper into the topic. So if I say a DNA break is ensued and the cell tries to repair, then my understanding is you guys already are aware of the repair pathways that would try to correct it, and if it's not corrected or if the damage is too big, what happens to the cell in that scenario? Okay? So we're going to go to the left of all of that, not further down. Okay. So let's start at the very top. We're talking about cancer incidence and death rates by geography. So we're looking at, you know, large land masses and how people live and, you know, the lifestyles and dietary habits and just exercise habits and stuff. So let's compare a couple of countries, or we could just do it by cancer type. So maybe it's this one. Nasopharynx in Hong Kong is the highest risk. In the United Kingdom, it's the lowest risk. And cervical cancer, Brazil, is the highest risk. Non-Jewish population in Israel is the lowest risk. So we can already see based on this list that there's patterns of which geography sees more likelihood of developing a certain organ type tumor. And, you know, even if you see, like, lung, even within the United States, it's a very state-specific, race-specific, you know, people, African-Americans living in Louisiana have a higher chance of lung cancer versus somebody living in this city in India. So you can see we've done, you know, there's lots of research done to show that there is a pattern when we try to line up the cancer sites versus where they occur at a higher rate versus at a lower rate. So that suggests something more than genetics. That suggests something more than what we're born with is going on. So the question of nature versus nurture does come into play. Okay, so let's move on to that since we've established. Now here is another example. Now this is a little bit into more details of about how, even though the genetics might be the same, just because of migration, we might see changes in the relative risk of developing cancer. So let's look at the Japanese population living in Osaka from 1970 to 71 and compare that across different tumors here. So the likelihood of prostate is low, colon is low. Stomach among males is really high of the Japanese population living in Osaka in the 1970s. And the breast risk among females is lower. And then, now imagine if these are, and then the Japanese population in the 1988 to 92, the pattern is still similar. It's the purple bar. Now compare at the same time, Hawaiian Japanese population from 1988 to 1992, which is the green bar. The rates of prostate cancer have gone up, colon cancer are higher, stomach cancer have gone down, and breast has increased among the females. So to say if it's the same population, so if these are immigrant families that migrated into Hawaii and they're from Japanese descent, but now they're experiencing or they have the relative risk that is associated with the native population in Hawaii. So now that sort of an argument for this another geography-related risk, that it is not just the environment, obviously, it's the lifestyle that you've changed to, the kinds of foods you're eating, the air around you, not to say that it's not oxygen, it still is oxygen, nitrogen, but, you know, the chemicals in the air that you might be breathing in the surrounding, things like that. There is not a direct direct correlation in any of that. This is just trying to explain what might be happening. Okay? So the takeaway from here, again, is the migrant population from Japan, when they did migrate to Hawaii, adopted or are now beginning to experience the same risks as the native population in Hawaii. So the epidemiological studies of cancer incidence do show that the rate of specific organ tumors varies among countries, and the migrant populations and their descendants acquire the pattern of the cancer risk of the new country that they migrate to. Over 80% of cancer deaths in Western industrial countries can be attributed, now it's again a correlation, to lifestyle factors such as diet, tobacco, alcohol, infection, occupational exposures. Now that is not to say that there is not a genetic component, but these are the factors that might aggravate and potentiate. And now we'll go over the history of when it started. It started as early as 1567, when there was a suggestion by Carcillus that wasting disease of minors might be attributable to exposure to blowgas, which is the same as arsenic sulfide. So we've known since last 400 some years now that, or 450 plus now, that things we are exposed to, things around us can contribute to cancer. More recent, it's still 300 years old, but following evidence in 1761 from John Hill, noted that nasal cancer occurred in some people who used snuff excessively. And then also in 1859, Bosson described oral cancer in tobacco smokers. The groundbreaking work was done with the surgeon based in London, Percival Pott, in 1775, who did a very systematic study and showed that men who were in their childhood exposed to chimney smoke because they worked as chimney sweeps reported increased risk of scrotal cancer. So that was the first one that actually correlated and showed a little bit more confidence. And then epidemiological evidence has been important in detecting carcinogenic substances. Prior studies, before we came up with all these tests to look for changes in the DNA or changes in the cellular components and the pathways, epidemiological studies were the key ones to determine, well, maybe cancer is not, it's a different kind of disease rather than a bacterial infection or autoimmune disease or any of the other things. Ran in 1895 reporting an increased incidence of bladder cancer in aniline dye workers in Germany. And there's a few more, evidence-based studies that are looking at various epidemiologists just comparing what they were seeing in their practice. Boveri was the first one in the early 1900s to propose the mutation theory of carcinogenesis, but at that time, the technological advances weren't there to make it amenable to a clinical investigation or a chemical investigation to see if that was the case. Because back in early 1900s, we didn't even know DNA and the structure and what was happening. So here's a pictorial of the same thing we just talked about. So human exposure to soot by chimney sweepers led to the exposure of benzopyrene, which was later found to be the active carcinogen in the chimney soot, leading to scrotal cancer. The second example is aflatoxin B, which is produced by a fungus, Aspergillus, which flavus that grows on improperly stowed grains, corn, peanuts, and things like that, so there's humidity and stuff, which has been shown to have an increased incidence of liver cancer. And then, of course, cigarettes. Now, we all are very well aware of how cigarettes can, over the years, can lead to lung and many other cancers. The active ingredients are Two of them are benzene, formaldehyde, acetaldehyde, and 1,3-butadiene. So this is, again, not a single exposure. This is a long-term exposure at what's the minimum threshold? I don't know if anybody knows, but it's a long-term continuous exposure. Looking at the cigarette smoke a little bit more to reiterate the point, the red line here is the global cigarette consumption that increased from the early 1900s over to the 2000s. And you can see how it is mirrored by an increase in cancers caused by smoking. This is estimated. But then you see there is almost a 30-year lag between starting tobacco use and experiencing cancers that are related or correlated with tobacco use, while the incidence of non-tobacco-related cancers are not reflective of the trend. So there is a lag. That's why we say it's a long-term use. It's not a single or, an intermittent use. Mutation and carcinogenesis. So this is going back to Boveri's idea that chromosomal changes or mutations in the genetic material lead to cancer. And in 1916, Kaiser introduced the term somatic mutation. Evidence in favor of the somatic mutation theory has been summarized. And most chemical carcinogens that we have studied are mutagens, meaning they change the structure or the sequence of the DNA. Most carcinogens and mutagens are strong electrophilic reactants. They attack the electrons and then leading to changes in chemical structure. Ionizing ultraviolet radiation and most chemical carcinogens cause lesions in DNA. We know ionizing radiation and UV radiation cause DNA breaks, leading to lesions. Defects in DNA repair capacity are associated with high risk. So that kind of flows if one we understand the DNA repair mechanisms and how if there is not a mechanism to repair the damage, then obviously the cell is going to suffer from the consequences of having DNA that is not functioning correctly. A high frequency of chromosomal aberration is correlated with an increased risk of malignancy. Pretty self-explanatory. Cell transformation by oncogenic viruses implies a change in genetic information because the virus, like a retrovirus or something, they will go and integrate and change. A malignant phenotype is inherited in the cell line, so that does talk about the genetic information being the carrier of it. Tumors are mostly monoclonal in origin, and chromosomal changes found in tumors are frequently found to be non-random. So known or suspected causes of human cancers. Here's just a list. It's a very small list of some of the ones. So scleral carcinoma, there's chimney smoke, condensate benzopyrene, liver angiosarcoma, vinyl chloride, acute leukemias, benzene, nasal adenocarcinomas, the hardwood dust, osteosarcoma, radium, skin carcinoma, arsenic, mesothelioma, asbestos, and vaginal carcinoma, DES, or diethyl sulbestrol, oral carcinoma, the snuff, and then ER-positive breast cancer, and the HRT has been linked to it. Now, this is a slide that is just to give you an idea of what compounds look like. So these are carcinogenic hydrocarbons, or that are most commonly associated with chemical carcinogenesis. You do not have to memorize the structure. You do not have to even remember their names. The point I'm trying to make is that these are very bulky molecules if you want to look at their structure. It's five benzene rings. That's a big thing. And it'll become clear why that big compound can create problems as we go forward, because the way it works is it forms addicts with the DNA, and the bulky then changes the structure of the DNA, leading to breaks. And if the repair machinery is not functioning properly, then you can imagine the consequences of that. So dibenzanthracene, benzopyrene, and all those other big giant names. But so these are some of the examples. The point was to make you familiar with the structure and why it's big and why it could create problems. Testing in lab animals is primarily how we screen potential new chemicals for potential carcinogenic activity. So the testing in laboratory animals is the most reliable procedure for detecting carcinogenic activity. There can be metabolic and pharmacokinetic differences between species, and that means, you know, the PK/PD in the human body versus the PK/PD in a mouse will be different, and sometimes that can give us false negative, false positive results. In that way, it's preferable to make sure we examine in multiple species just to get a good picture. Pure compounds should be administered to adequate number of test animals. Obviously, that's one of the things we know as researchers. You have to have a good sample size. The route of administration also can influence the tumors and the tissues affected. It's because the dose can be different based on whether you're taking it orally or whether the test animal is getting the drug via an IV or an IP or via a tail vein injection. So some of these are important things to think about when you think about in your own research if you wanted to pursue that way. And then direct cage bedding exposure to insecticides can influence tumor induction because, as we'll see, various chemicals that we are exposed to do interact with each other, do have an influence, even though we may not be exposed to them at the same time, but if we are exposed to them, then they do have an interaction. Although pure compounds are essential for identification of a carcinogen, such a test system will not detect synergistic actions. And then action of, especially, you know, the concept of tumor initiators and tumor promoters, because that's important, as we will talk a little bit more in detail. There is uncertainty on whether threshold levels exist for the detection of carcinogenic compounds. So, in other words, do you have to have a certain level of exposure before you start to see anything in terms of tumor development, or at least changes that might resemble tumor development? And we still don't know, because it's different for each compound, it's different for each genetic background that we're testing under. Things like that do affect. So in vitro testing of chemical carcinogens is probably the way to go, because as we all know, animal experimentation is expensive, and if we were to do it on a large scale with all kinds of chemicals we know of, it's going to be a big experiment. So the high cost of animal screening has driven the search for a short-term in vitro test. And the best known in vitro test that is devised, it was by Bruce Ames. We call it the Ames test for mutagenicity, which measures the mutation potential of the compound in a Salmonella bacterial strain that requires histidine for growth. So this Salmonella is modified to not be able to produce histidine on its own. We know bacterial biochemistry allows for them to produce all 20 amino acids on their own. They do not have anything called non-essential amino acids. So these Salmonella are special in the way that the histidine gene is mutated. So they need external histidine to survive. The mutation in this histidine gene can result in a reversion to the wild-type phenotype that permits growth in the absence of histidine. And that's exactly what this test measures. So we take Salmonella, which are incapable of making histidine on their own. We expose them to a compound that allows them to now revert, or at least the ones that do revert are the ones that will grow because the media does not have histidine. Because many carcinogens require metabolic activation, so this is one of the caveats of the system that uses bacteria, that many carcinogens require metabolic activation and the bacteria do not have the liver enzymes that mammals have. So the way around it was to incubate the carcinogens with rat liver S9 fraction, and hopefully that should, but obviously that has its own limitations. The theoretical basis for tests for this type is good, but it's not perfect, obviously, because we can't account for everything. But then it does give us some idea of which compounds are more potent carcinogens or mutagens than some of the other ones. So this is a pictorial again to sort of easier to understand. Now we start out with, these are the salmonella on a petri dish. These are the ones that are mutated, do not have the gene to make histidine on their own, so they rely on the histidine in the medium. The test compound is added, and then some of them will revert back. Depending on how many colonies revert back, that is a measure of how potent a mutagen this test chemical is. So as a modification to the simplified Ames test is adding the rat liver homogenate with the compound prior to putting it on the plate and then measuring the revertance. And what did Ames find? So this is a plot of micrograms of the test required to induce 100 salmonella revertance versus the carcinogenicity. Let me grab 50% reduction. Okay, so this is in the mouse model. So this is what we found here, and this is what we found in the model. And if you see the line, aflatoxin B, very little is required to make tumors. Whereas for something like benzidine and MMS, you need a lot more. So this is a more potent carcinogen mutagen than is compared to benzidine. And here is a list of what Ames tested. He tested things like black pepper, common mushroom, celery, rhubarb, cacao powder, mustard, alfalfa sprouts. Now we're going to think a little bit more before we eat or drink coffee. The important thing I want to point out is the burnt material. There's a lot of compounds over there, and they do the concentration does vary, but it was identified as one of the compounds that can, or the mixture was identified as something that can induce carcinogenic properties, or has properties. So moving on to what happens in the liver, because we talked about why it's important to add the liver enzymes when we're testing these compounds in the Ames test, and that's because the liver has the detoxifying enzymes, or also called the metabolizing enzymes, that work on compounds that are coming into the body from the outside. And so there are environmental pollutants, drugs, foodstuffs, heavy metals, things that get in. Phase one, a xenobiotic metabolizing enzymes will carry out a functionalization reaction leading to the metabolic activation of this compound. Examples are the CYP1234 family of enzymes. And this leads to the formation of reactive oxygenated metabolites, which can be carcinogenic and mutagenic through binding to DNA or protein. This would lead to oxidative stress, it could lead to mutations, it could lead to toxicity in terms of pH or change in localization of the proteins and things like that, which can lead to cancer. But what happens is that this metabolically active phase of the compound is usually short-lived, because the phase two enzymes come into play and they do what's called a conjugation reaction, where they will conjugate this hypermetabolic molecule with something called, something like a glutathione or another protein that would form hydrophilic products which can be excreted by the body, and then leading to detoxification reaction. So it's a two-phase process where first it gets converted to something and then it's quickly conjugated with proteins or other molecules, making it very electrophilic or hydrophilic in them excretion. However, it's possible, and then, you know, sometimes if these enzymes are not as active, then these build up and then these moieties stay in the body for longer. And this becomes clear in this one a little bit. So if we talk about genetic polymorphisms, where, because not all enzymes in everybody's bodies function at 100% capacity, some people and polymorphisms allow for people to react to the same thing in different ways based on what their makeup is. So if you were to think about genetic polymorphism in just these two classes of phase one and phase two enzymes, we're not even going to think about the whole body, but just these two. So in the xenobiotic metabolizing enzymes, for example, phase one enzymes or phase two enzymes now, and then also talk about exposure to xenobiotics. So if you're a person who works in the asbestos industry and you're exposed to the mesothelium, the asbestos a lot of times, so that increases your exposure. But that's just one example. We're just going to talk about the two bigger ends of it and how that the various combinations of these three can influence what your risk is, or a person's risk is. So if your exposure to xenobiotics is high and your phase one metabolic activation is high, but your phase two detoxification is low, so in the entirety of it, the exposure from this chemical is really high, and that's a high risk for cancer. Versus as the on the other end of the spectrum is a low exposure to xenobiotics, a low activity of the phase one metabolic activation, which means the xenobiotic compound that's coming into the body doesn't even get metabolized to be an active compound, and then you have a high detoxification, you have the lowest risk. And everything in between, all these other combinations sort of fall in between. The point is to say that, you know, not everybody who smokes will develop cancer, because sometimes, this is just an example to reiterate the point that everybody's genetics does matter, but exposure to these compounds and chemicals also is important. Okay. So cytokines are the enzymes that are the phase one enzymes. We talk about CYP1234 as being the family. Cytochrome P450s are involved in the biosynthesis of a variety of metabolites such as steroid hormones, cholesterol, bile acids, as well as degradation of fatty acids and steroids. However, CYPs also aid in oxidation and associated detoxification in xenobiotics. Now, this is their role that is very important. Among the options, the xenobiotics entering the body are polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, the PEHS, or the benzoylpyrene. So those were the big structures that I showed you earlier, and one of them is right here. So these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are big bulky molecules that are derived from tobacco smoke, broiled food, polluted environments. Benzoylpyrene is a common one. It's found in cigarette smoke, which is converted to this BPDE. It's benzoylpyrene diol epoxide. So the benzopyrene, when acted upon by CYP1A1 with NADPH and oxygen, gets converted to this intermediate, which when combined with water is converted to this other intermediate, leading to the action of CYP1A1 again with the NADPH and oxygen, leading to this benzoate BPDE, which is the ultimate carcinogen. So if this reaction weren't to happen in the body, benzoylpyrene would not be as effective and carcinogen as it is after this conversion. So what does benzoylpyridine do? The BPDE attacks the DNA at the guanine levels and forms this big addict. This big addict, now the guanine has this big chunk hanging with it every time there's a translation going on, and the structure obviously is not going to be the DNA helix anymore, because obviously there's this big thing attached to it. And this leads to breaks. It will need to be repaired, because it can't just fall off. Something has to take it out. So DNA repair enzymes or basic scission repair enzymes can go in and work to repair it. If it's repaired, well and good, great, move forward. But if it leads to double-strand breaks, and well, then it's anybody's luck about what can happen from there. Okay? So this is where I'm going to stop with what happens after the addicts are formed and there's a damage to DNA, because I think everything else after that has already been covered as part of some other lectures. With ethanol, this acetaldehyde dehydrogenase forms acetaldehyde, and then alcohol dehydrogenase will form the acetic acid. But then this can quickly, again, bind with the deoxyguanine again to form another addict. So ethanol or alcohol can be tumorigenic if you overexpress this, for example. If there is a polymorphism that allows for people to express a little bit more, even 5-10% activity is big enough. We're going to go over what happens with aflatoxin B and liver cancer. It's a fungal toxin made by mold growing on improperly stored peanuts and grains. One of the most potent mutagens known to us. Aflatoxin B goes undergoes activation with cytochrome P450, and this is the activated one where this over here is not in the pack side. Detoxification with glutathione S-transferase can lead to this. This is detoxified and excreted. The epoxide hydrate can also detoxify it, and this will be excreted. However, if the phase two enzymes are not as active as they should be, then the aflatoxin intermediate right here will form an adduct with the guanine. Deoxyguanine in the DNA, again leading to formation of this huge adduct, will change the DNA and will lead to damage if it's not repaired, leads to problems further down the road. Heterocyclic amines are another class of chemical compounds that arise from cooking food, especially red meat at high temperature. PHIP, PHIP is 2-amino and 1-methyl and whatever pyridine, is estimated to consist 2/3 of the total dietary intake of heterocyclic amines among Americans. So, average American just consume quite a bit of the PHIP. The oxidation of exocyclic amine of the PHIP leads to highly reactive N-hydroxyl PHIP, which can form DNA adducts. So this is the PHIP, this is the exocyclic amine, CYP182 acts to make this hydroxyl over here. Now this can attack the deoxyribose and the guanosine. So this, again, the deoxyguanosine. Okay, so, and then again, further down the line, DNA damage, repair not properly executed, leading to problems. So this is something that's it does happen in endogenously into every cell. It's called oxidation and deamidation of bases. It's fairly, I don't want to say routine, but it does happen on a regular basis within the cell, depending on the concentration of reactive oxygen species and things like that. So oxidation of bases in the DNA as a result of actions of reactive oxygen species can be mutagenic in the absence of subsequent DNA repair reactions. So this is deoxyguanosine oxidation leads to that AOXO-DG. And that would have to be repaired because you can't just lose you can't just change it. So it would have to be removed and repaired. And obviously that is work for the repair enzymes. Mispairing of the OXO-G with deoxyadenosine now leads to a mutation. How easy was that? So I was reading a statistic that about 10,000 of these spontaneous changes happen in each cell over a day. Every single human body is made up of around 10 to the power 13 cells. Multiply that by 10,000, that is the number of events of these kinds of things going on in everybody, every day, but we're still healthy. So this is the deoxy-5-methylcytosine oxidation and then some spontaneous deamination leading to deoxythymidine glycol. Now that is an adduct that would need to be repaired as well. So these are spontaneous reactions happening within the cell. And 99.9999% of the times they are repaired. Defurination and base deamination is another reaction that happens. It's a spontaneous deprotonation, frequently affects guanine within the DNA. So, you know, the guanine and deprotonation here. And then deamination reactions affecting purine and pyrimidine bases lead to changes in nucleotide sequences unless they are repaired. So these are the things that can lead to a mutation fairly spontaneously if they're not repaired. But our repair machinery is pretty good at detecting and repairing these by base excision repair or nucleotide excision repair as well. A substance that is not itself a carcinogen can sometimes be turned into a carcinogen. That's by action of enzymes from the liver or from, you know, other enzymes that might be acting on it. Procarcinogens are activation dependent. So there is a concept of a procarcinogen. So the molecule in and of itself applied on top of the skin may not be carcinogenic unless it's consumed. So there's those. So because that action of consuming it and the enzymes of the liver acting on it is what turns it into an ultimate carcinogen or a carcinogen. These compounds require cellular enzymatic metabolism to make them into an ultimate carcinogen. The resulting chemicals can be just as carcinogenic as direct carcinogens. Metabolism represents the organism's attempt to detoxify. So that was supposed to be a good system. It was built to help the body remove the chemicals that do not belong in the body. But then this happens to be an intermediate that's very short-lived, but if the enzymes are not at their 100% capacity or the load of the exocarcinogen is too much, then we get into the problems of these where detoxification attempts are not 100%. But through the detoxifying process, a chemical may be activated to an ultimate carcinogenic form. These pathways may be modulated by drugs, age, nutrition, hormones, and genetics. So, a schematic to kind of put it all in perspective. Carcinogens that are coming from the outside can be industrial, asbestos, natural, food-based, or it can be endogenous from within the body, so the deprotonation, the free radicals, and the DNA polymerase errors as well, because the mechanism is the same, just the offenders are different. And leading to DNA repair by various mechanisms, if the unrepaired DNA damage leading to cell replication, chromosomal arrangement, or leading to point mutation. So this kind of brings it all together and helps you, get the steps right. This is an example that I kind of want to talk about because it's very seminal work and it describes the process a little bit more pertinent to chemical carcinogenesis. So where this is called the skin two-step model, where what's done is, the skin of the mouse is shaved and you paint the top of the skin with a chemical. And then you follow a regimen, either you paint again over the same spot, you paint at a different spot, and you look to see if the chemical is able to produce papillomas or adenomas or carcinomas, things like that. So the classic ones are TPA or PMA, which is tetradecanoyl formyl acetate, which is the initiator, and then the promoter is the DMBA. So it also is an example of a two-step model where not one chemical is enough on its own. It does require interaction between the two chemicals. So this example kind of demonstrates that as well, that there can be synergistic activity between two chemicals. One on its own, they may not be enough. Painting of the skin of this mouse with the initiator, so TPA, PMA, and you leave it. You do it once, you leave it for 3 months, nothing happens. And then with multiple paintings with the promoter, which is this other compound, DMBA. So two compounds applied separately on two different mice, and what's the effect? So on their own, they don't do anything. But then you paint once with the initiator, on the same spot, you do multiple paintings with the promoter, results in a papilloma. They work together, synergistic activity, they have to be in the same spot, So it's more localized. You can't, you know, do one paint on the back of the neck and the other paint on the tail. It has to be in the same location. That talks a little bit more. We'll go into why that is important in terms of genetics of it. And then if you try to do this paint once with the initiator over here, but if you put the promoter over at a different site, nothing happens. Then painting with the promoter and with the initiator, papillomas, you stop the promoter, it goes away. And then you do the initiator, then you do the promoter, and you do more of the promoter, you stop promoter painting, you retain the papilloma. Paint with the initiator, then with the promoter, then you paint again with the initiator this time. This was promoter, this is initiator. Now this was papilloma, but this is a carcinoma now. So you can see the regimen, the timing, the sequence, and the cycle determines what's happening. And it's because of what the chemical, what the molecular changes are underlying all of this. This is the same slide, but with a different cartoon, so it's easier, again, to understand. It's the same logic. You have the normal cell. You paint with the initiator once. It's an initiated cell. However, if you do, and then you paint it with the promoter, it leads to papilloma. But if you take the normal cell and you only paint it with the promoter, nothing happens. Once for these papillomas, if you stop the promoter treatment, the papillomas will regress. You continue to do additional promoter treatments. It's an advanced papilloma. You halt it. It's promoter-independent papilloma, additional promoter, and then you do initiator, you get carcinomas. So again, it's talking about how exposures have to happen in a certain way. And the reason is because they lead to certain molecular changes within the cells. And those are what drive the formation of the papillomas and the carcinomas. So for the initiation of the tumor, something like benzoylpyrene, which is like a big long thing here, goes, makes a DNA adduct, leads to DNA damage. If you inhibit the nucleotide excision repair, that leads to mutations in cancer susceptibility genes, leading to alterations in things like, you know, big things like p53 and RAS. And then in the promotion stage, where it's an aryl hydrocarbon receptor, it acts at the xenobiotic response element sites, leading to extracellular signaling, increase in the CYP enzymes to make those metabolically active compounds in the phase one reaction, and these extracellular signaling increasing of all these increased signaling proliferation, decreased apoptosis, and cell cycling leading to more promotion events. So tumor formation or carcinogenesis, this has probably already been covered under a different topic. There is three distinct stages to it: initiation, progression, promotion, and progression. So after these two, the progression stage comes in where it's in uncontrolled division. Karyotypic instability because of these big changes in the DNA will eventually lead to chaos, and then apoptosis should occur, but if it's bypassed, that's leading to cancer. Another thing that's not really a chemical, but if it is persistently present, can lead to carcinogenesis as well, and that's chronic inflammation. Chronic inflammation and tumor development have been linked, and the examples include bladder carcinomas and chronic cystitis or schistosomiasis. A bigger example is gastric carcinomas are very, very intimately involved with Helicobacter pylori infection that induces gastritis, and if that's not treated for a long period of time, there is a high potential for developing gastric carcinoma. Hepatocellular carcinomas with Hep B and C viruses can lead to cancer. So these do not really do a damage to the DNA, but it's that chronic inflammation that's the culprit here that does the damage to the DNA. And links between inflammation and cancer pathogenesis. So So many inflammatory conditions predispose to cancer. I have the examples listed over here. Functional polymorphism of cytokine genes are associated with cancer susceptibility and severity. That kind of gives us clues that, you know, that signaling through those cytokines is elevated. Distinct populations of inflammatory cells are detected in many cancers. And then you can read the rest of it. So this is a tumor promoters now that I wanted to sort of bring to your attention as well, and that where they act and what kind of cancers they have. So these are conditions, actually, not just chemicals, though. So, you know, promoters are the DMB and the TPS, the initiator. Not much is linked with other chemicals as tightly as TPA, DMB, and the two-step model. But some of the tumor promoters for the human body is, if you want to think about ovarian and breast cancer, so historically, if you want to think about the age at when the woman conceives her first child, if it's too late, there is a higher chance of ovarian and breast cancers and things like that. Okay. This is the flowchart that talks about chemical carcinogenesis in animal models. We suspect that these are going to be also carcinogenic in the human species, and there will be a disease linkage. We identify and develop methodologies for measuring chemical-specific biomarkers and then determine the relation of biomarkers to exposure in the human population. So try to link it to see if we actually see that particular carcinogen that was detected in the human and the animal model is actually relevant for humans, just because there can be a species difference. And then if there is a cross-sectional study, then it's even better. It adds to the strength of the study. The validated exposure markers that are important, because then it's not a correlation anymore. We have a cause and effect, and there's a marker for that. And then we validate the risk markers and then you know, do case control studies and cohort studies and clinical trials to determine if those are true. So again, I'm just reiterating the same point kind of over and over to drive the point that chemical carcinogenesis affects metabolism. It is affected by metabolism in the liver. It will be excreted most of the times by the xenobiotic metabolizing enzymes, but if it is not, then it leads to these cell cycle DNA repair, differentiation, and apoptosis perturbations. And it can be a genotoxic mechanism, a non-genotoxic mechanism involving inflammation, immunosuppression, reactive oxygen species, receptor activations, sometimes epigenetic silencing, which will lead to altered signal transduction, whereas when the genotoxic mechanisms, it's more DNA addicts, chromosome change at the basic genetic level, leading to genomic damage, which leads to hypermutability, well, karyotypic instability, and leading to cancer. And then it will all be manifested as evasion of apoptosis and loss of proliferation control for the most part for cancer to develop. Some of the genes that we have shown to be linked to those kinds of alterations, we've talked about these under a different lecture. I know that because I did teach that. Experimental transformations, say for PRB, which are inactivated by the large T antigen, resistance to growth inhibition, evasion of apoptosis, and immortalization for these two. Small T antigens, mitogenic independence, and metastasis and invasion. RAS can do apoptosis invasion and all of these other stuff. So again, it will start at the chemical level, but then it will go down to DNA, leading to perturbations in metabolism, inflammation. And then the ultimate will be one of the tumor suppressors or one of these, you know, high up or nuclear receptor or a target or transcription factor that not cultivates, that regulates multiple genes that are further down, that are important in the cell cycle, that are important for proliferation, that are important for apoptosis to happen. Once those are perturbed, because those are the clear ones, if there's because the changes occur very non-random, so it's all a selection process. So now, that is not to say that the inflammation of the genotoxic chemical is choosing P53. It's not choosing P53. P53 loss or P53 inactivated cells are the ones that have the growth advantage. And those are the ones that survive, and those are the ones we see. It's a non-random event. The other cells that do not have the P53 loss, for example, will die out or will not have the advantage. P53 is just an example. P53, P10, RB, P16, P21, those are all the other ones. But they have to be in a very crucial pathway. Examples of etiologic mysteries, this always is interesting. So high birth weight, like lifestyle, dietary factors, or medical conditions, high birth weight can have increased risk of premenopausal breast cancer, infant acute leukemia. These are all correlational, etiological. Processed red meat, increased in ER-positive breast cancer. A high body mass index, multiple cancer types. I think there's an exercise, hormone-responsive breast cancer decreases the risk of that, so that's good. So there's etiological factors that we still don't know what's affecting or why it's leading to what it's leading to, but there have been correlative studies to show that these are true. Most of the material that I took is all from the book. Some is from chapter 2, chapter 11, and chapter 12, if you wanted to go and read a little bit more into detail. The paper that I had given out is the second one, Loeb and Harris. It's a pretty detailed historical view. Some of the slides are from there as well. And the other four in this list are a good read as well, but they are rather detailed. So it's there for you. But I believe the questions for the test will be from the lecture. Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is for further reading in the book, and I just told you where to look for it. All right, questions?